Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I can't be here live today, so I decided we'd do a little journal club experience about an amazing researcher who is reversing dementia. Reversing dementia not someday in the future with experimental molecules that can be patented and sold at high prices, but right now with materials and methods that you and your loved ones can put into action. His game-changing paper, Reversal of Cognitive Decline, was published in 2014 in the journal Aging, and we'll be doing a deep dive today into this research and how you can put the information in action in your life. But first, a little information about Dr. Dale Bredesen. Dr. Bredesen is a well-respected research scientist with over 30 years of work and hundreds of published articles in peer-reviewed journals. His early work was in programmed cell death of nerve tissue, a process referred to as neuron apoptosis. Later, he focused on Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and the mechanisms by which the cell's mitochondria signal another organelle in the cell to initiate a self-destruct sequence. Later, he began researching ways to inhibit cell death. He and others discovered that one major trigger for the self-destruct switch was oxygen. This sounds a little odd at first to the layperson. Don't our brain cells need oxygen? Well, yes, of course, but oxygen also has a dark side. It reacts with things and changes them chemically. Think about rust. Think about fire. These two examples that we're all familiar with cannot happen if there is no oxygen present. Oxygen is friendly. When atmospheric oxygen, two molecules, break apart, the single molecules are lonely and immediately look for something to react with. In reacting, they often change the structural properties of the compounds they react with. One prime example is DNA. We've known that oxygen interacts with DNA and damages it for many, many years. In fact, much of the work on cancer prevention has focused on reducing oxidative stress. And that's where Dr. Bredesen's work comes in. The same mechanism by which oxygen interferes with DNA and leads to mutations is also at work in our brains constantly. Many things create extra oxygen. They're called oxygen-free radicals, and medically, we often refer to this as oxidative stress. But oxidative stress is also one of the major mechanisms by which our bodies keep us safe. Our white blood cells use it to kill bacteria. Thus, there's a delicate balance that needs to be understood. And that's where Dr. Bredesen's many years of research come in. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the paper, however, I want to muse for a couple of moments about science, how it helps us, but also how it hinders medical progress. The scientific method is 397 years old. It'll be having its 400th birthday in the year 2020. Rather fitting when you think of it, because what the scientific method did was give us 2020 vision for observing and understanding the world around us. It was the first systemic method that allowed us to pry apart the secrets of nature and led to all of the technological achievements that we experience and take for granted today, including the sound of my voice in your ear. We date the scientific method from Francis Bacon's book in 1620. Francis Bacon lived in a world of superstition, of overgeneralization, and a dominance of traditional unproven facts that got in the way of making scientific advancements. Bacon's method begins with a description for making careful, systematic observation, which are important to produce quality facts. He then proceeds to advise the use of induction, the ability to generalize from a set of facts, one or more axioms. However, he stresses the necessity of not overgeneralizing beyond what the facts truly demonstrate. After you've generated an axiom or a hypothesis in modern parlance, the next step is to gather additional data. Particular types of facts and data that are especially useful are negative instances, exceptional instances, and data from experiments. The whole process is repeated in a stepwise fashion to build an increasingly complex base of knowledge, but one which is always supported by observed facts, or more generally speaking, by empirical data. By this definition, we can see that astronomy is a science. In modern parlance, science has been hijacked by one aspect of experimentation, the so-called placebo-controlled double-blind study. In medicine in particular, this is held up as the only way to establish facts. But the fatal flaw of the placebo study is that it's only able to analyze one variable at a time. Any medical treatment that involves multiple variables is almost impossible to study, according to the paradigms of the placebo trial. In fact, coincidentally enough, the only thing that really can be studied that way is, in fact, drugs, which may account for the fact that physicians, the chief purchasers of drugs in our societies, when you stop and think about it, are trained to respect only placebo trials. I'll leave you to think about that one for a moment, and let's go back to the idea that some things need to be studied in a fashion that does not involve placebos. A good example is any activity involving humans who are not going to be penned up in a motel room for a couple of weeks, but instead are out there in the environment, interacting, talking, stubbing their toes, and having fights with their siblings or wives. These individuals will have multiple variables going on in their lives, in spite of whatever experimental model that we're attempting to look at. The scientific establishment does not consider science derived at through observational means of humans to be, quote, high quality. In fact, placebo trials are, by definition, the only high quality research that can be done. This forces our science into very specific lines. High quality research is necessary to validate something and get it paid for by your insurance. Therefore, the only thing that can be validated is a drug. Have you ever heard of a placebo study about whether or not you need to take out an appendix when it is inflamed? How about placebo knee replacement? Ever hear of that? And yet these things are accepted in our culture, and I might add reimbursed. There's some interesting paradoxes and double standards that are applied across the board in quote-unquote scientific medicine. But let's return to Dr. Bredesen and his revolutionary work on dementia. Dr. Bredesen suggests that we need to take a network-based approach rather than a target-based approach. The key concept in this groundbreaking paper is the idea of a comprehensive combination therapy. So, for a way to understand Dr. Bredesen's explanation of all the research findings, I'm going to give you a visual image rather than drowning you in terminology. In Alzheimer's disease, we see an accumulation of amyloid beta, which is a protein that is toxic and triggers nerve cell death. Think B is for bad. That's easy to remember. Now imagine a string of beads. That's how we'll visualize the amyloid precursor protein. This string has three yellow beads, then three red beads, then six green beads. Now there are two pairs of robot scissors in the cell. The alpha scissors cut right after the last red bead and make amyloid alpha. The beta scissors cut right after the first green bead and make amyloid beta. The three yellow, three red fragment left over from the alpha scissors is another set of alpha scissors and makes more alpha amyloid, which is harmless. The 3 yellow, 3 red, 1 green fragment left over after the beta scissors cut the breaks. The 3 yellow, 3 red, 1 green fragment left over after the beta scissors cut breaks into another set of beta scissors and a second compound that actually impairs the breakdown of beta amyloid, so it accumulates more rapidly. It's kind of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice segment in Fantasia. The beta fragments of amyloid precursor protein make more beta fragments and amplify the problem. Brains drowned in beta amyloid that is built up too quickly to be broken down. And when the mess accumulates past a certain threshold, well, the mitochondria step in and trigger cell death, and memory and skills evaporate. So the basic tenets of Dr. Bredesen's work are that we need to identify the factors that create more beta scissors and eliminate those, and identify the markers that create more alpha scissors and magnify those. So the first step in that is optimizing the measurable nutritional markers that lead to that goal, creating more alpha scissors and fewer beta scissors. The second basic tenet of this paper is to address each and every feasible factor that can be reached. The third premise is that if you can achieve a threshold of alpha over beta, you break the cycle of nerve degeneration. And that's what makes this paper so exciting, is that there are some demonstrable case studies in which this appears to have been achieved. I'll be telling about those in a few minutes. The fourth tenet is the importance of personalizing the approach, measuring the individual lab values, and identifying what needs to be shifted in a given individual based on their genetics and the markers that can be measured. When I come back in July, I'll have more information about this, as I plan to attend a conference that is dedicated to the preservation of the brain in early June of this year. In fact, I'm at that conference right now while you're listening to this program. We're going to jump into a few case studies now because they're very impressive. And before we go any further, I want to just say that none of the people in these case studies was able to perfectly achieve the program that we're going to lay out for them. You have to do the best you can. But the point is that it is humanly possible to achieve reversal of fairly significant disability using this program. So let's start with our first case. A 67-year-old woman presented with 2 years of progressive memory loss. She held a demanding job that involved preparing analytical reports and traveling widely, but found herself no longer able to analyze data or prepare the reports, and was therefore forced to consider quitting her job. She noted that when she would read, by the time she reached the bottom of a page, she would have to start at the top once again, since she was unable to remember the material she'd just read. She was no longer able to remember numbers and had to write down even a 4-digit number to remember them. She also began to have trouble navigating on the road, even on familiar roads. She would become lost trying to figure out where to enter or exit the road, and she also noticed that she would mix up the names of her pets and forget where the light switches were in her home, where she'd lived for years. Spooky, huh? Her mother had developed similar progressive cognitive decline beginning in her early 60s and had become severely demented, entering a nursing home, and died at approximately 80 years of age. When the patient consulted her physician about her problems, she was told that she had the same problem her mother had had and that there was nothing that he could do about it. He wrote memory problems in her chart, and therefore the patient was turned down in her application for long-term care insurance. After she was informed that she had the same problem as her mother had had, she recalled the many years of her mother's decline in a nursing home. knowing that there was still no effective treatment and subsequently losing the ability to purchase long-term care, she decided to commit suicide. She called a friend to commiserate, who suggested that she get on a plane and visit, and then referred her for evaluation. She began System 1.0 and was able to adhere to some but not all of the protocol components. Nevertheless, after 3 months, she noted that all of her symptoms had abated. She was able to navigate without problems, remember telephone numbers without difficulty, prepare reports, and do all of her work without difficulty, read, retain information, and overall, she became asymptomatic. She noted that her memory was now better than it had been in many years. On one occasion, she developed an acute viral illness and discontinued the program and noticed a decline, which reversed when she reinstated the program. 2.5 years later, now age 70, she remains asymptomatic and continues to work full-time. So what was this miraculous therapeutic program? Following an extended discussion of the components of the therapeutic program, the patient began on some, but not all, of the system. Number one, she eliminated all simple carbohydrates, that's sugar and white flour and starch, and increased vegetables, fruits, and non-farmed fish. This led to a weight loss of 20 pounds. She also eliminated gluten and processed food from her diet. Three, in order to reduce stress, she began yoga and ultimately became a yoga instructor. Four, as a second measure to reduce the stress of her job, she began to meditate 20 minutes twice per day. Five, she took a 0.5 milligram of melatonin every night at bedtime. Six, she increased her sleep from the 4 to 5 hours at night of her baseline to 7 to 8 hours per night. Seven, she took methyl B12 1 milligram each day. Eight, she took vitamin D3 2,000 units each day. Nine, she took fish oil 2,000 milligrams each day. Ten, she took CoQ10 200 milligrams each day. 11. She optimized her oral hygiene using an electric flosser and electric toothbrush. And I'm going to stop there and parenthetically tell you that inflammation from gum disease is a strong risk factor for dementia. And if you aren't taking good care of your teeth, you need to start pronto, because this is a big one, folks. 12. Following a discussion with her primary care provider, she reinstated hormone replacement therapy that had been discontinued following the Women's Health Initiative report in 2002. And regular listeners will know what I think of that study. 13. She fasted for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast, and for a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime. The reason for this is that when you fast, your cellular disposal trucks are available to get rid of cellular trash, and that's when the beta amyloid gets eliminated. And 14, she exercised for a minimum of 30 minutes, 4 to 6 days per week. We know that exercise increases something called nerve growth factor in the brain and leads to the formation and replacement of synapses and dying neurons. Here's case study number two. A 69-year-old entrepreneur and professional man presented with 11 years of slowly progressive memory loss, which had accelerated over the past 1 or 2 years. In 2002, at the age of 58, he had been unable to recall the combination of the lock on his locker, and he felt that this was out of the ordinary for him. In 2003, he had a fluorodeoxyglucose positron emission tomography test, which was read as showing a pattern typical for early Alzheimer's disease. This test, which uses radioactive glucose to measure brain activity, showed reduced glucose utilization in the parietal temporal cortices bilaterally, with the left deficit greater than the right in the temporal lobes, and showed preserved utilization in the frontal lobes, occipital cortices, and preserved utilization in the frontal lobe, occipital cortex, and basal ganglia. In 2003, 2007, and 2013, he had quantitative neuropsychological testing, which showed a reduction in the California Verbal Learning Test from the 84th percentile to the first percentile, a Stroop color test at 16th percentile, and a delayed auditory memory at 13%. In 2013, he had genetic testing and was found to be heterozygous for APOE4. He noted that he had progressive difficulty recognizing faces at work. This is called prosopagnosia, and had to have his assistants prompt him with the daily schedule. He also recalled an event during which he was several chapters into a book before he realized that it was a book he had read previously. In addition, he lost an ability he had had for most of his life, the ability to add columns of numbers rapidly in his head. I'm going to skip the next paragraph, where Dr. Bredesen talks about the biomarkers in this patient and what they showed. But just in the highlights, he had normal testosterone, normal cholesterol, low inflammatory markers, and a good hemoglobin A1C. But what he did have that was abnormal was a high homocysteine and a very, very high level of copper relative to zinc. His thyroid was functioning okay, and his weight was in normal limits. He began on the therapeutic program, and after 6 months, his wife, co-workers, and he all noted improvement. He had lost 10 pounds. He was able to recognize faces at work, unlike before, was able to remember his daily schedule, and was able to function at work without difficulty. He was also noted to be quicker with his responses. His lifelong ability to add columns of numbers rapidly in his head, which he had lost, returned. His wife pointed out, although he had clearly shown improvement, the most striking effect was that he had been accelerating in his decline over the prior year or two, and this had completely halted. So what was this patient's therapeutic program? Well, he fasted a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. He eliminated simple carbohydrates and processed food from his diet. He increased consumption of vegetables and fruits, and limited consumption of fish to non-farmed and meat to occasional grass-fed beef or organic chicken. He took probiotics. He took coconut oil, 1 teaspoon twice a day. He exercised strenuously, swimming 3 to 4 times a week, cycling twice per week, and running once per week. He took a 0.5 milligram of melatonin at bedtime and tried to sleep as close to 8 hours per night as the schedule would allow. He took herbs, bacoba, monaria, ashwagandha, turmeric. He took methylcobalamin, that's methyl B12, and methyl folate, and pyridoxine 5-phosphate. And he took citricholine, a precursor for the cell wall of neurons. He took 1 gram of vitamin C a day, 5,000 international units of vitamin D, 400 units of vitamin E, 200 milligrams of CoQ10, 50 milligrams of zinc picolinate, remember that low zinc level, and 100 milligrams of alpha lipoic acid a day. He also took a low dose of DHA and EPA, which are components of fish oil. The wonderful thing about this paper is that these doses have been empirically arrived at through scientific studies, and they're actually very low compared to the doses that you'll find in some supplements. So it seems very reasonable that there's a synergy or a multiplicative effect when you add all of these components into an individual, which has long been my idea. Case history number 3, a 55-year-old attorney suffered progressively severe memory loss for 4 years. She accidentally left the stove on when she left her home on multiple occasions and then returned, horrified to see that she left it on once again. She would forget meetings and agree to multiple meetings at the same time. Because of an inability to remember anything after a delay, she would record conversations, and she carried an iPad on which she took copious notes. But then she forgot the password to her iPad. She'd been trying to learn Spanish as a part of her job, but was unable to remember virtually anything new. She was unable to perform her job, And she sat her children down to explain to them that they could no longer take advantage of her poor memory, that instead they must understand that her memory loss was a serious problem. Her children noted that she frequently became lost in mid-sentence, that she was slow with responses, and that she frequently asked if they had followed up on something she thought she'd asked them to do, when in fact she had never asked them to do the tasks to which she referred. Her homocysteine was 9.8. Her inflammatory markers were low. Her hemoglobin A1C was also low. And her hormone levels were actually pretty decent, with a low insulin and decent thyroid functioning. All of the things that a conventional doctor could possibly think of to check on a dementia workup. After 5 months on her therapeutic program, she noted she no longer needed her iPad for notes and no longer needed to record conversations. She was able to work once again, was able to learn Spanish, and began to learn a new legal specialty. Her children noted she no longer became lost in mid-sentence, no longer thought she had asked them to do something she had not asked, and answered their questions with normal rapidity and memory. This is going to sound familiar now. She began on the following therapeutic program. She fasted for a minimum of 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and for a minimum of 12 hours between dinner and breakfast. She eliminated simple carbohydrates and processed food from her diet. She increased her consumption of fruits and vegetables, limited consumption of fish to non-farmed, and did not eat meat. She exercised 4 to 5 times per week. She took melatonin, 0.5 milligram at bedtime, and tried to sleep as close to 8 hours per night as her schedule would allow. She tried to reduce stress in her life with meditation and relaxation. She took some methyl B12 and some pyridoxine 5-phosphate. She took citricholine, that precursor for the cell wall. She took vitamin D3 and CoQ10, DHA and EPA, which are omega-3 fatty acids, about 1,200 milligrams of these twice daily. She also started on bioidentical estradiol and progesterone, and she worked with her primary care doctor to reduce the amount of antidepressants that she was taking. There are another 7 cases in this paper that are not described as fully. Of the 10 cases studied, 9 improved. Those who had left work or were contemplating leaving work were able to resume working at a normal functional level. Those who had quit working and were retired did not return to work, but did not suffer further decline. One patient, aged 60, who had a positive amyloid PET scan for Alzheimer's and was in late Alzheimer's disease at the time of entry into the study, did not improve. So this clearly indicates that there is a critical period where you can break the cycle, change the thresholds, and rebuild your brain. But if things get rolling and have too much momentum, well, it's rather like an avalanche at that point, and there's no stopping it. When you go to the website for this program, you'll find a link to a set of references. And these references demonstrate that there are numerous physiological parameters that feed into this balance between amyloid alpha and amyloid beta. Numerous factors that can increase the effectiveness of the alpha scissors and reduce the effectiveness of the beta scissors. Numerous genetic variations that feed into this, hormonal variations, the presence of trophic factors like that exercise-induced brain nerve growth factor that I mentioned. Sleep-related factors and exercise-related factors. And again, harking back to what we talked about in the beginning of this particular segment, inflammatory factors and oxidative reactive species that influence the development of these diseases. Essentially, we don't want that broom with the buckets to get rolling, And if it does get rolling, we definitely don't want to chop it up. We must identify the factors in a given individual that are most critical. And there are a number of markers in the bloodstream that we can use to do that, that were used in this study. So what are some of the important biological markers? What are some of the things that you can ask your doctor to test? Well, number one is the zinc to copper ratio. And this can be a serum test, easy to get from routine lab testing. If there's a high copper and a low zinc, you're in trouble for your brain, and there's also an increased cancer risk. You'll want to filter your water if you have copper pipes, and definitely increase your zinc with supplementation. Up to 50 milligrams of zinc is considered safe when there's a high copper level. Another factor that some people have is absence of a protein called ceruloplasmin, which binds copper, and that too is a routine lab test that can be checked. You'll want to look at your hemoglobin A1C. That's, well, basically an indicator of how high your blood sugar has been, and if it's elevated, that indicates high insulin levels in anyone but a type 1 diabetic. Insulin competes with amyloid beta for breakdown by the enzymes that process it. So you certainly don't want to slow down your amyloid beta breakdown by having high blood sugar and therefore high insulin. A third one is high sensitivity C-reactive protein. This is often called cardio-CRP because conventional medicine recognizes it as a risk factor for heart disease, but it's also a risk factor for dementia. Inflammation biases the system towards increased amounts of amyloid beta and interferes with the breakdown of amyloid beta. As I mentioned, that's a race. Break it down before it builds up so that the mitochondria don't trigger cell death. Homocysteine is a blood acid that goes up when there are low levels of B12 or problems processing folic acid. Independent studies doing just B12 and folic acid supplementation in people with early dementia have shown fairly significant improvement. But taken in concert with all of these other measures, it's extremely powerful. Your homocysteine level should be below 8, although if you look at lab tests, the reference range considers 12 normal. Well, it may be normal, and it may be typical, and it may be average in people with no apparent current disease, but it's not optimal, and that's what we're going after here. We're going after optimizing these markers so that we can reduce the global risk of dementia. You also want to get a sleep study and rule out sleep apnea. If you have any of the red flag symptoms for this, and that includes snoring and daytime drowsiness, particularly in the afternoon. You need 8 hours of good quality sleep, and you don't want to deprive your brain of oxygen episodically throughout the night, because that generates, ironically enough, inflammation and reactive oxygen species. If you're female, you definitely want to get hormone testing and consider hormone supplementation, because the data is very clear that this is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease in susceptible individuals. And finally, physical activity is key. Now, obviously, you'll lie to your doctor about your physical activity, but don't lie to yourself. You need 20 minutes a day of moderate physical activity. Get a calculator. Take 220 and subtract your age. Now calculate 80% of that number. That's your target heart rate for that 20 minutes. Weightlifting is also very good, maybe even better, but be prudent to avoid injury, since if you go too gung-ho and injure yourself, the subsequent inactivity during your period of recovery is much, much worse than the biggest toxin dose that we can imagine. Other things to think about are heavy metal toxicity, and in people who have a history of exposure to metals like cadmium or lead, people who solder, people who do ceramics with lead glazes, people who've traveled or spent a couple of years in China on business, these would all be individuals where I would go looking for heavy metals and work to get those out of the body if I found them. So what am I saying? Ultimately, I'm saying that Dr. Bredesen's work gives me a sense of hope that this is not genetics' destiny, that this is not an, oh, too bad, so sad, you're going to be in a nursing home. This is something that you can take action on and turn around. It takes dedication and perseverance, but these case studies give me a real sense of optimism that it is possible and achievable, and I wanted to share that good news with you today. Be sure to tune in to the first program in July, because I'll be talking about what I learned at the conference, and I'm sure I'll have more specifics and more advice for you on the subject of neuropreservation. May we all live long and prosper. I thought I'd round off the hour by answering some emails. So here we go. This one goes out to Martha, who doesn't give us a location. Dear Dr. Dawn, I've listened to your podcast for 2 years and I need your advice. I have Morton's neuroma and recently plantar fasciitis. The podiatrist I see placed me in insoles. I took anti-inflammatory medication for 3 months and suffered a stress fracture in one foot. I used the ice bottle, stretched my feet and legs, saw a physical therapist for 20 sessions, and still my feet ache. It is a soreness on the bottom, pain as I step and aching in the middle of the day. I believe the stress fracture was related to the arch insert being too aggressive. However, the podiatrist is now relaxing it gradually. I'm at my wit's end with this discomfort. I've started taking curcumin capsules, 200 milligrams, and CoQ10. I'm on a statin, and I've always taken the CoQ10 with it. Should I take more than 200 milligrams of the curcumin? The brand name is Terry Naturally Curamed. Can you advise me any further? All right. Well, Marcia, first of all, you will not be the first patient that I've talked to who has actually been injured by an overly aggressive arch support. I believe that arch supports should actually be soft, and I really think that the hard plastic supports that are supplied by podiatrists may in many cases actually be a little bit too aggressive. So starting with your easiest question, what about the curcumin? I typically use 200 to 750 milligrams of absorbable curcumin daily. How do you know if your curcumin is absorbable? Well, either it's in a liposomal format or it's co-packaged with about 10% piperazine, which is a compound found in black pepper that helps your body absorb the curcumin. Now, I wanted to tell you about the stairway stretch. And the stairway stretch is something that physical therapists don't teach, but after years of advising patients how to do it, I've become fairly confident that you can do this without hurting yourself. It's important to listen to the instructions. First of all, you need a stairway and a banister. Second of all, you need to be barefoot. And what you're going to do is you're going to place the knuckles of your foot, that is to say, the metatarsal joints on the stair, and the arch and the heel of your foot are going to be floating in midair. With both feet on the same stair, you're very gradually going to transfer your weight to one side. I didn't know from your email which side is injured, but let's just assume that you have the problem on both sides for the sake of this discussion. So you're going to transfer to one side and gradually let all of your weight be on that foot. Then you're very, very slowly going to let the heel drop as far as it can. You're going to feel that stretch in the back of your calf, and you're also going to possibly feel it at the heel if you have an insertional tendonitis, and also on the sole of the foot. But really what you're looking to do is stretch the calf. As you let your weight rest on that one side, balancing on the banister, after about 15 seconds by the clock, you're going to notice that your leg and the calf can relax just a little bit further. So let it drop down and give it another 30 to 45 seconds so that you've got a full minute there. Now it's time to transfer your weight. Do not, repeat, do not lift up on the leg that you're standing on. Instead, lean over to the opposite leg and transfer the weight so that you do not clench the calf muscle on the side that you've been stretching. This is very, very important. This is how you injure yourself if you're not careful. So lean over to the other side, transfer the weight, let that side take the weight. And then once the weight is on the opposite side, then you let that calf muscle tighten up again and just come passively back up into a neutral position. Now you repeat this. Your weight is now on the opposite side, and you're gradually going to let that calf muscle stretch out slowly. And as it stretches out with the natural body weight, you're going to notice where you feel the pulse, where you feel the pull. And again, you're going to do that for at least 45 seconds, but even better is a minute. Use a clock that you can listen to the ticks or where you can see it. The timing is very, very important for stretching. Something magical happens between 15 and 20 seconds that allows you to achieve that fully lengthened stretch of the muscles. Transfer back to the other side, same thing. Transfer your weight first. Do not tighten the calf. Let it passively come up to its neutral position. And then once you've transferred the weight, let it drop by relaxing the calf and letting the heel fall. You should do this about 4 sets on each side. Honestly, my friend, this is a magic stretch, and I have had enormous feedback from patients that this has worked for their plantar fasciitis. Since you don't tell me where the stress fracture is, Marcia, I'm not able to give you any specific advice on that. But with a stress fracture, it always takes 6 to 8 weeks of not using the bone, and that can sometimes mean being in a stiff boot or a cast, which unfortunately tightens up all the structures that you're trying to stretch. So I think if you're not getting good results with this, it's important to figure out where that stress fracture is, and you may actually need a bone scan to do that. I hope this has been helpful, and don't hesitate to email me back if you have further questions. Our next email goes out to Ellen in San Francisco. Subject is bloating and weight gain and gas. Dear Dr. Dawn, for about a year, I've experienced extreme bloating after eating and subsequent weight gain. I eat well, consistently, blueberries and flax cereal for breakfast, cheese stick, almonds, and fruit for lunch, salad with lots of organic veggies, beans, quinoa, main staple, and salmon twice a week and 2 eggs once a week. The bloating is extreme, and my stomach appears distended. Diagnosed with GERD 7 years ago, that's gastroesophageal reflux disease, by the way, folks. Someone told me I could have SIBO. That's small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. I take a probiotic once a day. 3 years ago, due to extreme weight loss, I was tested for celiac, SIBO, and everything came back negative except for GERD, and I also tested positives 3 times for small bowel cancer. After many MRIs and an Octorio, which I have no idea what she meant by that, parenthetically, nothing was found. Back to the bloating weight gain problem. What should I do? Your advice is appreciated. Thank you. All right, Ellen. Well, I'm not sure how you tested positive for small bowel cancer, and that would be an important piece of information for this, since it's really not clear to me what test you could possibly have had. All right, that being said, as far as the bloating is concerned, people who have gastroesophageal reflux disease, heartburn can sometimes be a symptom of that, but not always, often have the opposite of what you would expect. You would think of heartburn as being excess stomach acid, and that's what all the Rolaids commercials on TV always told us. But actually, heartburn can be not enough stomach acid when you need it, and too much when you don't need it. For example, when a person eats food and is trying to digest it, the stomach wants to add a lot of hydrochloric acid to the food mix. One of the things that hydrochloric acid does is sterilize the food so that you don't get too many bacteria in your small intestine. Another thing it does is help the enzymes that the stomach secretes digest that food. Stomach's a little bit like a washing machine, and it goes through its agitation cycle, and then it goes through its rinse cycle, and that rinse is the gastric emptying and the pyloric valve, the trigger to open and allow stomach contents to exit into the small intestine, is in fact stomach acid. So if you don't make enough stomach acid, you may actually end up keeping things in your stomach too long. Now, the amount of stomach acid that you've got in there, even if it is enough to trigger release, is still enough to irritate the esophagus, which is not designed to handle acid. So as a result, that stomach contents, which is kind of trapped in the stomach on an eternal agitation cycle, starts splashing up against the upper sphincter. It causes swelling and irritation, and then eventually you lose your seal and things actually reflux, go backwards up into the esophagus and lead to heartburn. In many cases, this heartburn is silent, but the swelling that it produces further compromises the valve, and so now you're walking around with a full glass of acid that splashes up whenever it wants to, perpetuating the problem. So, your bloating may be a result of inadequate stomach acid. And this is how that works. Because the stomach acid is not quite adequate to get emptying, it's also not quite adequate to get sterilization of the bacteria. So you're dumping larger amounts of bacteria into your small intestine than the body can handle. Some of those bacteria are actually able to take up residence in the small intestine, which normally has 1/1,000th the number of bacteria that you have in the colon. But if that number becomes 1/10th or 1/100th of the bacteria that you have in your colon, then when those bacteria see sugar or starch, they're going to metabolize it into gas, and you will get rapid bloating after eating. There are other possibilities. You could have a problem with the pancreas, and you might not be producing enough pancreatic enzymes to digest fat. And here's how you tell what's going on without spending a lot of money. You get yourself a tape measure. Before you eat, you measure the circumference of your belly at the belly button, a nice easy marker to hit, and you write it down. Then you eat what you're going to eat, and for the first week, you're going to eat a low-carbohydrate, no sugar, vegetables only, no grains, no flour, no alcohol, no honey diet. And after the meal, at 30, 60, and 90 minutes, you'll measure the belly circumference. The second week, you're going to do the opposite. You're going to eat a high-sugar, high-starch diet. You have all the alcohol that you would ordinarily want to consume. Don't go crazy. And measure your belly at 30, 60, and 90 minutes. One of those is going to be worse than the other. If the high carbohydrate diet is worse, then you probably have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and you're going to want to seek medical attention. Do not, repeat, do not go to a gastroenterologist for this. They will give you Zyfaximin and tell you you'll be fine, and in 3 months you'll be worse off than before you started. Go to a functional medicine doctor or a naturopath who is experienced in the management of this, because the treatment is going to be augmentation of your stomach acid, improvement of your vagal nerve tone so that you make your own stomach acid eventually, elimination of the bacterial overgrowth in your intestine, and also very careful re-inoculation with good bacteria. But you've got to be careful with too much probiotics, because I have seen people actually give themselves SIBO if they had low stomach acid and took high doses of probiotics. Too much of a good thing? Not necessarily good. That's all for this week's show. I'll be back live on July 1st with highlights from the annual Institute for Functional Medicine's symposium and answers to your questions on KSCO 1080. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.